From multiple Audible locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Chell Wong, award-winning game composer, to discuss game audio tools and workflows. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Welcome, Chell.
Hi.
We've been wanting to have you on for a little while. We've talked about it idly in the gig, you and I, and we finally got you here to talk about the nitty-gritty of audio stuff, which I'm very excited to learn about, because in my friendship with you, I've always wanted to have this conversation, but in all the social settings we've been part of, it's much more free-flowing and goofy, and I like want to get down to brass tacks, so I'm excited for today's episode. Yeah. So sorry, listeners, if you were expecting a rollicking good time, because that's not what's on the docket for today.
No. I was going to say, maybe we should add a disclaimer. This is going to be even nerdier than usual, just to be prepared.
Yeah.
Watch me somehow accidentally derail it. I'll just say something and then it'll be like anime.
Well, I was actually going to derail it a little bit too. I wanted to know what award you won as a composer.
Oh, actually, yeah, my microphone's in the way, but that weird red circle behind me is it's from Reboot Developer. Actually, you know what? I'll tell the story. So,
I did it.
You did it.
Yes.
All right. So, hi, my name is Cho Wong and I worked on a game called Kine. Kind is a puzzle indie. It's a puzzle indie game about three instruments trying to become famous, and actually, it's going to be launched on Steam this year on October 19th, which is not long from now.
Yeah. It might be around when this episode goes live. So, really good timing on our part.
We totally planned it.
Hey. So, Kine launched last year on Switch, PS4, Xbox One, Epic Game Store, and then a month later, Google Stadia launch. So Gwen, being a normal adult person, goes to bed at like maybe 11 or something. And I know this because I am not a normal adult person, and I go to bed anywhere between, well, last time was like actually midnight to 6 a.m. So it's a little bit of an inconsistent thing. So at some point, I get a message from her, and she's like, hey, are you awake? And it's at like 1 something. I'm like, that's weird. And I get to it by the time it's like 2 something, I think. I don't remember. It's pretty late. So I'm just like, hey, yeah, what's up? And then immediate response. I have something to show you. Oh. And she sends me a picture. And it's this award that says Reboot Develop Red Best Audio 2019. She's like, this is yours. And I was like, what? I didn't even know that she was at a conference. And I guess there was a small conference in Canada called Reboot Develop Red. I was supposed to go this year, but, you know.
Yeah. Pandemic.
And they have another one called Reboot Develop Blue in Croatia. So I end up getting nominated, which I didn't know. And then I end up winning. And she, I guess, did basically my, not victory.
Acceptance speech.
Thank you. Yeah. And she was like, hi, this award belongs to, my name is still Mitchell, but like Cho Wong and blah, blah, blah. And like, yeah. Something more eloquent than that. I also did get nominated for the Gang Awards, which is the Game Audio Network Guild. And that was really cool because that was like actually there was like a lot of competition. Like, it was best sound design in a casual or social game. Hearthstone. Call of Duty Mobile.
Oh.
Who's heard of Kine? I don't know. Something by Capybara Games, something by that game company. And it's like, oh geez, like,
and you got nominated for that?
I did, and
dang,
I didn't
win,
which is fine because I didn't expect to win.
That's wow, that's beautiful.
So cool.
Call of Duty Mobile won, so like, sure, they deserve it probably. I haven't played the game. I assume it sounds good. It's AAA.
that award you got and didn't know it. That's like the perfect way to win an award. There's like no anticipation. No nerves, no like pretending that you don't, that like that just being nominating is an honor.
Yeah.
Like it's like you have to do a little bit of that for this other one, but
yeah.
Like, legit though, for Gang, like it is actually an extreme honor to be acknowledged by my fellow audio people. It's like, wow, maybe I'm not a complete fraud. so it was weird though, because the Gang Awards were supposed to be at GDC, which didn't happen. Right. So we had to like pre-record acceptance speeches. And then like, I think like straight up in mind, I was like, I don't expect to win this, but in case I do, and then I just like rambled off some stuff. I'm like, I don't know. Mine was like 10 seconds of just me saying like 20 names. I fit that many names in that many seconds. And of course no one saw it. So
it's kind of cruel actually that they have to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, to, like, it makes sense. Like, what are they going to do? Like, we're going to call you right then and there live on Twitch and you're going to be like, oh, hi. And everyone else is just stand by and like,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Good night.
And that's what would happen live though, right?
Yeah. I mean, kind of. Yeah. Sort of. Well, a little.
Maybe. Well, we've derailed this very well.
Good job.
I should say.
Good job.
But I do want to ask how you got involved. What I heard about Kine partly because it had a lot of really good buzz, but also that it was the only indie game on Stadia at launch, not many people talk about in those terms, but that's what I found interesting about it. But I would like to hear about how you got how you connected with that game and how that process started and went before we get into all the nitty gritty nerdy stuff.
So, I guess to start about how I started my game career, because it's kind of integral to how I met Gwen in a sense. I went to school to be a music teacher and things didn't go right. Eventually, after graduating, I did a year of nonprofit and it nearly killed me. I was very, very exhausted. And there were several reasons outside of the program itself. There's just some things that just weren't lining up in my life. I considered going to grad school for bass trombone performance, which I am not good enough for. Like, I'm decent, but especially now, like in my today's lens, I'm like, I'm very rusty and I'm not amazing at it. Right before my program ended, I knew these two guys from a Discord server for a game that we all played. And they're like, hey, we're making our own game and we're looking for another coder. And maybe an audio person. I'm like, hey, I've like literally never done this before, but like hit me up in 3 weeks. And like, yeah, sure. And so they actually did hit me up. I'm like, well, I guess I gotta. They had like, hey, here's this character. We want a theme song for him. I was like, okay. So I just like sang something in my phone, wrote it out in Finale, transcribed it. I transcribed it into Finale, which I hate and despise. I'll talk more about it when we get the tools. And then they're like, wow, this is really good. And they gave me another character. And they gave me another character. I'm like, oh, wow. And then I came across Akash the Car's YouTube channel, and he has like a video on like how you can freelance in game audio. I'm like, huh. My whole life, people have been telling me to write music for video games, but I'm like, you can't just do that. So basically, that was like the sign, and like now Akash is also like my friend. I actually did a panel with him not too long ago for IGDA LA, which is like, wow, that's crazy that I'm doing a panel with my mentor. How time flies. On his advice, I networked like crazy. I before the pandemic, even, I was going to 5 to 6 meetups every month. And so it took me several months until I found my first contract. And so after that was signed, like literally a month after that contract was signed, I go to another meetup. Normally our meetups are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, near the MIT area. This one was actually in the heart of Boston at the Prudential Center, which is like kind of a weird place to get to if you're by car, but it's like not too bad by train. And so it was like a weird venue. We were inside the Microsoft store and there's like, I know there's two other audio people and I'm like still trying to figure out my way around. I don't know a lot of people yet. And so I see Gwen, who is now Gwendolyn Bond. She recently got married. Anyways, she was there and she was sort of quietly showing off a game. And I'm like talking to her and I'm rambling and I'm bumbling and I'm tripping over my own words. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I heard about Flame in the Flood. And I'm like, I haven't played it. And she's like, oh, you seem cool. Like, I could just get you a key. I'm like, okay, I'm not totally blowing it. So I try out her game. And one, I really like puzzles. And two, as I'm talking to her, I'm also like, oh, yeah, I'm a composer. I play trombone. And one of the characters is trombone. And so I think little did I know it at the time, but I was maybe exactly who she was looking for. Mm-hmm. I was brand new. I was a trombonist. I know jazz. And I really like puzzles and maybe some other factors too. So she's like, hey, I promised my friend that I'd let him take a pass at the audio. But after that, if if I'm not super duper into it, I'll give it to you. And I'm like, oh, cool. So for like that couple of weeks where I was waiting, I'm like, oh, don't get your hopes up. She's probably going to hire a friend and something like that. And then she's like, I passed up on it. Like, all right, show me what you got. And yeah, she took a chance on me. Hmm. And I ran with it. And I worked my butt off. So, fantastic. Yeah, I'm still forever grateful for her taking a chance on me. I guess to check out her other game, Lab Rats, which is coming out later in the start of next year.
You know, we had Heather Gartner on 2 weeks ago to talk about imposter syndrome. And a lot of what we talked about was like that feeling of like, that you were sort of starting with, like not thinking you're good enough, not thinking you belong in these spaces. And but you put in the work. You brought yourself to these spaces. You made yourself known. And sometimes what it takes is someone taking a chance on you. And that's not something you can always engineer. But the more opportunities you give for yourself, the more likely it is to happen. So that I think it's a really good story for people to hear who are waiting for that to happen to them. And it explains necessarily why it's not guaranteed to happen, but there are ways to prevent it from happening, which is to not put in the time that you did.
To not show up, right? Like the opportunity, you got to show up and meet people because all the work gets done by people.
Yeah.
It's a really cool story. It's so serendipitous hanging out in the Microsoft. I don't know. It's just a really cool story.
Yeah. Of course, there are different strategies now in this era, but that's outside the scope of this episode. Right.
Yeah. It's funny because the one thing I feel like I know and do really well is networking. And then you're like, let's talk about audio stuff. I'm like, oh, geez, but I'll do it. I might as well. I should.
Well, Stephen prepared this outline for this interview, but like this is something that I have a little background in. So I feel like I'm going to take the wheel a little bit on asking some of these and also oohing and eyeing at your answers. But let's talk about just like the nitty gritty. Like, I think like everyone's got their own different setup and there's no one setup that's perfect for everybody. But I want to hear about all the tools you use. And let's start with like, what's your main DAW, your main audio software?
Reaper Gang. Yeah. All right. So first things first, a DAW is a digital audio workstation, and it is essentially how audio people do most of their work. I think the most famous and well-known DAW is maybe GarageBand. It is, of course, free and therefore not as complex and as robust. But like for anyone who's just like, oh, I only have GarageBand, like, no, that's super legit and it's a perfect place to start out. If you want to go up from there, there totally are options. I know that Logic is usually a common step up because it's similar. I use Reaper. Reaper is something that was recommended to me by a friend because it was, one, inexpensive. Two, does everything. Those two things alone make it super worth it to me. It's pretty, what's the word I'm thinking? There's a lot of customization. And so like to some people, it can feel kind of rabbit holey. I don't even really dig too far deep. I'm just like, man, it's so cheap. There's a free trial period that is incredibly forgiving. And after a time, I'm like, yeah, I will buy the license. And so relative to other DAWs, it's so inexpensive.
Isn't the license like $19 or something?
Wow. No. It's $60.
Okay. That's still pretty
good. I have a memory because I used Reaper for back in the old days. I did stuff for Rock Band Network. Does anybody remember that? I've told the story on the show before, I think. Mm-hmm. But where you actually use MIDI to create Rock Band note charts. Mm. And it's the tools that Harmonix used, and they opened up the to a wide variety of people. And I started a little business we'll find the episode where I talk more in depth about it. We'll link in the show notes. But I used Reaper for this purpose because it was the only thing that worked with all of Harmonix's like plugins and stuff. And I remember paying next to nothing. It felt anyway at the time for it, and then realizing like, wow, this is more than just this tool for this Rock Band thing. It looks like a real like in-depth piece of, and the MIDI tools are great, which is I think something that you really really want in a DAW. Like, it's why that Pro Tools is like not as good, because its MIDI tools are not great.
I have never used Pro Tools, but I despise Pro Tools with burning passion because it's the quote unquote industry standard, but that's not even the case anymore. Maybe in the film industry for game audio, it's a lot more varied, but Pro Tools just crashes all the time. I feel like it doesn't look good. It crashes all the time. I had a friend who was mixing and mastering my EP on it, and it was delayed by literally like 4 months because it crashes all the time. So yeah, I have no desire for anyone to use Pro Tools if they're new. I'm just like, use the answer is like, oh, what DAW should I use? Like, if you already have a DAW, use what DAW you're comfortable. Otherwise, use Reaper. And if you don't like the DAW that you're using, use Reaper. And if you do like the DAW you're using, check out Reaper because it's got a free trial period. That's really forgiving. Like, what are you going to lose?
Yeah, yeah. And there's communities around all of these. So I think a lot of times you want to use the standard or what everyone else is using or what has the most community support. Certainly, if you're a game dev, you're thinking about that for which engine you're going to use. But I, for music, when I compose, I use Reason because it's very MIDI focused. And I picked that even knowing that it's a much smaller, more niche program. And it wasn't something that I was going to be so involved in that I knew I was going to need a lot of, I was needed to Google a lot of stuff. But I felt pretty comfortable because every one of these tools has really robust communities. Mm. So whatever you use is so I agree. Like, use what you use.
So it's funny because when I was in college, I had a music technology class. And they taught it like first semester freshman year. So frankly, I was like too busy figuring out life and how to be a college student for me to like understand things. And so they taught us Reason. And I had no idea what a DAW was back then. And I had no idea what I was doing in it. And I'm like, what is this? I don't get it. Like, why can't I just learn Sibelius and Denali? And we did. But for some reason, Reason was the DAW that they taught us. And I forgot about it for a long time. You are actually the first person I know that like uses Reason primarily.
Not surprised.
have you ever used FL Studio? That's the service my brother uses.
I haven't, but I have heard good things. A friend of mine said that he really likes the MIDI editor in that. So yeah, it seems good and it seems legit, but I honestly haven't touched any DAW other than Reaper. Okay. And there was a very, very small light version that came of Cubase that came with my audio interface. It was like weird and it didn't look like a DAW, at least the thing that I had. So I just was like, I don't get it, and stopped.
Sure. I was just going to say that my brother, yeah, he's been using FL Studio for a long time and he likes it. But I think like part of the reason why he used it is because he's kind of a hipster and he uses things where people are like, oh, this is a bad thing. Don't use it. He's like, I'll
Steve,
show
don't
them.
Slander.
I gotta give him some fodder when he comes back on the show in a year.
The only one I hate is Pro Tools, and it's not even bad in terms of functionality, just that it crashes. Do people still think that FL Studio is bad?
I don't think they do anymore, but back when my brother Charles started using it, I think people did think that. And this was a long time ago. This is like 15 years ago or something.
Well, your brother's a good use case because he's been a long-time user of that program.
Yeah.
And that's part of what makes it good for you in particular. If you have a history with something, if it does what you need it to do, if it works for your workflow, then like that's as good a reason as any to like stick with it. Like, I personally love Pro Tools as an editor mixer, but it does crash all the time. And I haven't used it in years because I find for recording analog audio and mixing, I like Audition. And that's what we use for the podcast. And then for composing, because I'm not a great musician and I don't record analog instruments anymore, Reason really suits me very well. It's very all in one. It's very much a laptop and a tiny keyboard kind of a studio that suits my workflow because music is just it's sort of side to what I normally do. Yeah. But I want to hear, Chell, because you are a multi-instrumentalist, I want to hear about your recording setups. Like, do you use a lot of MIDI, samples? Do you record a lot of your instruments? I can see many in the frame behind you on our video call.
So it's funny because I actually don't record a lot of instruments. I just like instruments and collecting them, but majority of my soundtracks are actually with MIDI. I use live instruments for very specific things, but in general, yeah, I actually do MIDI. I come from a background of like being classically trained, from like a orchestral wind ensemble kind of world. So that's just kind of like what I'm used to. And I think about things in terms of like real instruments. And so like thinking about synths is kind of hard for me. Like, how do I get this specific synth sound? I don't know. usually I ask a friend, and or like I'll scroll through presets and see what like sounds cool. Mm-hmm. As for recording music, for Kine, everything was MIDI except for two instruments, which was it was funk guitar that my friend Trey Hodge recorded, and the string bass line, which is constantly playing. It was a VST that was also doubled by Luno or Christopher Smith. He's also an indie dev. For all of the movement, the trombone and accordion especially, that was all live recorded, where I had my back to this closet, and I had this weird metal cage. They're like these sort of metal cage things where you like hook them together and you can make boxes out of, and you can make shelves and whatever. So I made, I made like this shell, and I threw my blanket over it, and I put my microphone just like awkwardly hanging over it. And I had like no space. And so like I used an Xbox controller that was like connected to my mouse to like click the record button on my DAW while I was trapped in this cage. I have a video of it somewhere, but it's also like out of date. So I might like show it again, but I don't know. I disassembled the cage. And so if I need to record something seriously again, I'll reassemble it. But also the accordion, the sound comes out of the right side. So I had to like tilt my body to the left while like leaning over to see my sheet music across the room. As it was like the most jank thing ever.
That's amazing. I love that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that grassroots kind of development style.
Yeah, me too.
It's amazing. That's one of the things I think people who are getting into, especially now that people are getting into podcasting or are setting up their Zoom setup because everyone's doing meetings and wanting something a little bit more to webcam. Like ultimately, the bar is pretty low for like good quality equipment. I would say it's still worth spending money on things that matter. And I think maybe that's why like research and knowing more about how these things work. But like I know for this podcast, we use $20 mics and sounds great. Like not, you know. But so yeah, just a cage and a blanket in a closet is as good as a fully sound isolated Abbey Road studio or something. Yeah. Like it really is, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have maybe it's a little jankier and you have to work at it in a certain different way, but I think it's good to hear that. Mm-hmm. You know. So yeah, you do most MIDI and you record a little bit when you have to. What are the tools you use? What's what microphones do you have? What audio interface do you use for those things? And do you find that it's actually not that important because you don't use them that much?
So for the audio interface, I don't actually know enough of it to feel like there's a big impact. I just got one that was cheap. I got the UR22 Mark II by Steinberg. I know a lot of people use Focusrite. There's something else that I heard about. I don't even really remember, but this one was like, I think maybe $100 to $150. As for microphones, for a really long time, I actually used the SM7B every day, but lately people have been saying that like I've been extra quiet. Hmm. So like really recently I started using this, it's the Audio Technica AT2035. I've had this nearly as long as I had the SM7B, but I just didn't use it as much. Also, condenser microphones pick up background sound a lot easier. So on one hand, if I'm like leaning back here or if I'm like leaning forward like this, it's not too bad. Whereas the SM7B is like literally one of the most, it's so quiet. I have max gain on that microphone and it still is only really heard if you're actually like right next to it. For anyone starting out, I would also recommend the Shure SM75 or Shure SM57. It is really inexpensive and you can find them used basically everywhere and they're like nearly indestructible.
Yeah, there's two Shure microphones that people even who aren't in audio are well familiar with because you've seen them in music videos a million times. The 58 is the standard looking microphone with the silver cage, the silver circle at the top. The 57 is the one that Chell's just showing us. Which is has a sort of a, it looks a little bit more like a cigar, I guess. And when I was in radio, like we used the 58 for vocals and the 57 for amps. But I don't even know why. Like they can both be run over by a truck. They're both indestructible. They're used in touring bands and stuff. But you have to talk directly into them is the drawback, right?
I was just saying that the at least with the 57, like, you don't need to like boost the gain all the way up.
Oh yeah.
So there, like, so there's a difference between a dynamic microphone, a condenser microphone, and frankly, you don't need to know too much about it. Like, there's a lot of resources out there, but a dynamic microphone is usually a lot more direct in how it picks up sound. And a condenser microphone, you need to have like what we call phantom power, and it's like 48 volts through, which every audio interface will supply. And it just picks up sound usually all around. And there's stuff we could talk about, cardioid patterns, but it doesn't matter really. Not really. That's how I feel, at least.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's good to know these things, but it's good to kind of know them.
Yeah.
It's like I like to get into the weeds. I'm a read the manual person, but honestly, it's once you know a little bit, you know all you need, I would say, you know, but it can be helpful to know a little bit because you can get easily confused. Mm. Like, why isn't it working as well? Because you didn't provide it phantom powers. Like, why do I need to do that? It's like, just read this 5-minute article and it's all you ever need to know for the rest of your life about it, you know? But finding where those things is kind of difficult. So it certainly helps to have like a network of people or to sort of join communities. And that's something we always talk about on the show, is like sharing information. But I don't think there's a lot of need for people to be experts, right? On some of this stuff. That's different for, like, if you're a programmer, I think that the more you know about debugging, the better you are. Like, there's always a limit to how much, you know, is necessary. But there are certain types of things that you can get by, and you should be comfortable getting by and spending your time on your craft, I suppose, right?
It depends on what your focus is. You know, if you want to specialize in music, then yeah, work on that more.
Yeah. And it depends on like what kind of, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to focus more on post-production or audio engineering or, you know, the things that would require, I think it could be very daunting to like need to know all of this stuff.
Frankly, I don't.
Yeah.
Identifying what you don't need to know a lot of is actually almost as hard as actually learning it, right?
Yeah, it's really intimidating. And I feel like it's easy to fall into the trap of like, I have to know all of this before I can start. And frankly,
yeah.
Starting something, I think, is like the second hardest thing to do, where like finishing, if it's like a project, then finishing is like the hardest thing to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to fall into the trap of like, how much do I have to know? And like all this sorts of stuff. No one taught me how to write music, and I learned about I already kind of knew some stuff about microphones from school. But like, I didn't know a lot of stuff. Things I just watched a lot of YouTube tutorials and I asked for a lot of help. Mm-hmm. And I still go through, like, I use MuseScore, which is free. I write my MIDI in MuseScore. I port the MIDI into Reaper. I humanize it some, and I still mix it and whatnot. But like, you don't need expensive stuff. You don't need to know everything. You just at least need to get started.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good point that you have about like asking for help, because, and I don't want to get us off track, I know we have a lot of technical stuff to get into as well. But people love to help other people. You know, like, there's someone who's further along their journey who has expertise or has knowledge that you don't, and they probably want to share it. Just put your question out there and someone will come to your rescue, most likely. Not always, but sometimes. You know, I think it's a thing you can do. And don't feel like you're going to be judged, because go back and listen to the imposter syndrome episode. Everyone's thinking the same thing. Am I good enough? Am I good enough? Am I going to get, you know, found out as someone who doesn't know everything? No one knows everything. Put your question out there. Ask for help.
Yeah, yeah. And charge forward without all the answers. Like, that I think is, and maybe you'll be better tomorrow, but if you don't do anything today, then, you know.
For sure you won't, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's how I felt. That's one of the reasons why I chose a Reason as a DAW, because it has all of its like integrated synthesizers. And so I didn't need to learn about how to program a synthesizer or get a bunch of plugins. I could just use presets and change some dials. And that made me very comfortable. Like, I felt very intimidated by a lot of that stuff and felt like if I was just using the one of five presets, then I would be found out as like, is, you know, it's like using the three voices on a Casio keyboard. It feels like you're not making anything new, but then it's easy to forget that like so much of it is your own artistry, and it doesn't matter. You could play it all on a grand piano, and it's the same grand piano. It's been played for hundreds of years, but you can still make something new with that. And so that made me comfortable. I think everyone needs to find their own way of being comfortable. It's not, it isn't going to be the same for everybody, but I think we're all saying it, like, you can just, you know, you don't have to worry about not knowing it all yet.
Yeah. There are only 12 notes in the Western scale, and people are doing new stuff with that all the time.
Yeah. I will say that, like, there's the one thing that Reaper doesn't have is, like, built-in instruments, but, like, there are a lot of free synths that are really good. Like,
yeah.
Helm by, I think it's Matt Title. Helm is really good free synth. Tal Noisemaker is a really good free synth. And, like, I used Helm a lot for the most recent thing that I worked on. And, I mean, I was paid pretty well for it. So, like, it's fine to use free stuff. There's a lot of really good stuff. And also, mm-hmm. as, like, what Mark said about, like, oh, are people going to find out? I have only recognized two instruments, I think, ever from, like, listening to other people's work. Where it's like, hey, this is the Helm preset that I use called Fluffy Landscapes that I also used a lot. Like, hey, I recognize that. And then the other one was like, hey, is that the free key bass by Mark? I don't even remember what it's called. But, like, no one cares. I'm like, hey, I yeah. use that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, it reminds me of just, like, all of the, like, free assets and stuff that we use for, really, for programming. Frankly, you should... I bet if you look at any, like, AAA code, you'd see a bunch of the crap that they found from Unity forums. They just, like, copy-pasted it for their yeah. own purposes. It's the same kind of stuff.
Yeah, it does it does mimic a lot of the same things you hear about people using code samples and store assets for game development. Mm-hmm. And the same kind of psychological path you take from thinking that's cheating all the way to, I need to get this done, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
So let's talk about, I think, yeah, we threw a bunch of names in there. I think we'll put a lot of those in the show notes. So we've been kind of investigating some of the tools that you use and some of the things we've talked about. But let's walk through it step by step. So let's, maybe this is a hypothetical scenario because every little task is different, but you've got to write a piece of music. Where do you start?
Typically, if I have a song for something, there's usually some sort of parameter of, like, what's the song about? Who is it for? Where is it played? You know, I get that stuff. And then I hope that inspiration strikes me. And if it doesn't, then I kind of have to force it. But typically, I start writing in MuseScore, which is a free notation writing software. Other notation software includes Finale and Sibelius, but I despise Finale and I owned it and I paid money for it. And now I use free stuff over it. So, yeah, I use MuseScore. I write something. I think particularly I'm very melody driven, and then I'll, like, write harmonies underneath it. Sometimes I'll write harmonies if there's a specific groove, and then I have to figure out how to put a melody on top of it. Sometimes I don't like that as much, but the groove is really good, then it works. Eventually, I get more or less everything I want done in there, and then I hit export MIDI, and I drag and drop that into Reaper. Once I'm in Reaper, I then apply instruments to these MIDI files, or to the MIDI, because each of the MIDI will be on a track, and then I just put an instrument on those tracks. Occasionally I'll record something live that is, like, written, but even though I play trombone, sometimes I feel like it just doesn't blend as well as, like VST trombones do. There's a lot of nuance and human elements to things that you can get with playing live, but sometimes there are some things that are really good at faking it. And frankly, I also, like, I've thought about this for a while. I feel like the authenticity of instruments is, like, a little overrated. Seeing things with fake instruments sound great. That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that, like, okay, it's not like a real person playing it. Whatever. The song still bops. After I write the instrument, also, like, I typically use, like, contact instruments, like native instruments. So if there is, like, one thing that I do recommend saving it for, it's Complete, because, like, contact is really important, and a lot of things use contact, and it comes with a buttload of synths and a bunch of other things.
That's Complete with a K, right? That's it's just a bunch of instruments, right?
Yeah, Ellen?
I have a vocabulary question.
Yes.
When you say contact instruments, what does that mean?
So, Native Instruments is a company that makes plugins. They have a plugin called Contact. Contact is also with a K, because for some reason, everything that starts with a C, they just instead replace with Ks. So,
okay.
Contact is a instrument sampler player, I think is the best way to describe it. Basically, a lot of things that are like instrument samplers will mm-hmm. be through Contact. So like some things you just load up through like their own browser. Other things you can just have it installed through the Native Instruments installer, which is not a great thing sometimes. But typically that's not too bad. So for example, the majority of Kine was written using Swing and Swing More by Project Sam. Those are expensive, but I was paid a lot up front. And so then I'm like, I'm going to splurge, because this is like, it was like one of the big purchases of my career. And to this day, it's still one of the biggest purchases of my career. So I loaded those up through Contact, and it has a lot of really good sounding jazz instruments. So that's what Contact is. And Contact is also part of a bundle called Complete with a K. And there's three versions of Complete. There's like Complete Select, Complete Standard, and then like the Full Complete, which is so much money. I have the standard one, which I got on sale on like Black Friday. So that comes with a lot of synths, a lot of instruments for Contact. Some plugins like a compressor and an EQ and some, like, there's just a lot of things that it comes with. I went through and started I was putting all my plugins into a spreadsheet and just being like, I've never used this, I don't even know what this is. So at some point I need to mess around, because at least with Complete it covers a lot of bases that I ever needed. So after I write everything, then I have to mix, and mixing is hard, and I like, no one taught me composition, but no one taught me mixing, and that's a lot harder for me to figure out. So I've been learning as I go. After you mix, there's a process called mastering, which I don't even know how to describe. Mastering is just like you typically give someone else the master. They make sure that it sounds good. They'll do a couple of tweaks and they bring the volume to a certain level. I don't know. Mastering is weird.
Mastering was described to me a long while back as the post process. So when you're mixing, you're taking all the individual pieces and you're equalizing them, you're leveling them, you're mixing them, right? Like you think of a mixing board. It's just that. Mastering is, and this isn't always the case, I suppose, but it's done after to the final piece. You export that file and you have your stereo track or whatever. And then the mastering is doing all that same stuff, but to just one track. At least that's not a full definition, but that's, and then you think about it, oh, right, because mixing it is great, but when you master it, you want it to sound good on headphones and good on speakers, and it's going to be one file that needs to do both of those things. And like, it's much more of a science, I think, which is why a lot of people, musicians and people who are like great, like post-production audio engineers, mastering is like a whole nother universe in a way. It's like very fine grained, and you can also get away with not doing it, like, because it's very fine grained. That's the way it lives in my mind anyway. I don't know if, does that sound?
Yeah. Right, it's, I have talked to some people who are students at Berkeley, and they're talking about like the specific tool for mastering called like Sequoia or something, which is like insanely expensive. And they're saying that like to their trained professional ear, they can hear when someone uses like the auto master function and like an Isotopes Ozone, but like I don't know. it's if you give it to someone who knows what they're doing, they can do something with it, and if you don't know what you're doing, it's just like there's some guides and you can just try it, and it's like a very small process if you don't know what you're doing, I feel like. So I think mixing is like, if you want to learn like, oh, do I need to learn mixing, like mixing is where like you do the majority of your like making things sound good. Like the writing has to, like, one, the writing sounds good, okay, sure, and then you put the instruments on it, and then like mixing is the process of like, okay, we move things left and right so that there's a lot more stereo width, and you, and like not everything is just like crowded in the center. You can EQ things. EQ is it called is short for equalizer, and that's for like moving different frequencies. So you can raise some frequencies and you can lower other frequencies, and you can even cut out frequencies completely. So the biggest things are EQ, compressor, and some say like reverb. Compressor is a matter of you bring levels more consistently. And so it's like, okay, so if a note is like really long, like da, or if it's really short, like da, shorter ones, like you can have a compressor and it will bring down the initial attack, which is called a transient. So it'll bring down the initial attack of the sound and it kind of brings the level down. But also with a compressor, you can bring the entire level up. So in general, it typically makes things louder, or it can make things that stick out less.
Hmm.
And then reverb.
We can demonstrate that here on the show because we run the audio for the show through a compressor. So if I yell really loud like this, and if I whisper really loud, really quiet like this, it the loud part sounds louder. But in fact, the actual volume in your headphones, dear listener, maybe not to us on the call because we haven't run the compressor yet. But the volume, if you were to run it through an analyzer, would be about the same. And so, because there's a difference between volume and loudness, and a compressor is what, you know, gets you there. It's so that when you're playing audio in your car with the windows down, you can still hear the quiet parts, you know, on the radio, right?
I guess also, like, the last thing is reverb, which is, I think most people know what reverb is, but it's like how long something sounds after it ends. And typically, like, I mean, you can make things very reverby. Also, like, before this becomes confusing, people typically say that if something is reverby and it has a very long tail and it lasts a long time, that's wet. And if it doesn't, then that's dry. Typically, I actually, like, what's interesting is that a lot of the things that I did for Kind was, like, really, was pretty dry. And then we had someone who did a little bit of sound design outside of what I already did. And his stuff is so... so wet. And I know that to people out of context, like, that sounds gross and I hate it. I'm like, I'm sorry, but to other audio people that makes sense. So it was just like, it was really wet and what I had was really dry. I'm like, So I had to, I did make mine a little bit more reverby and I tried to cut off the tails of his somewhat, which was a little bit weird. I'm like, oh man, I wish I had the sounds pre-reverb so I can at least make them shorter, but at the same time, it sounds nice.
Yeah. That's one of the things that brings us to the other half of this. There's something that composers are regularly asked to do, which is sound design. And you had to do this process where you took audio from two different creators and try to make them sound like part of the same universe. And that alone is sound design. But can you talk a little bit about that and how you got into that part of it?
For sound design? I hate sound design. I've talked about this with other people before, but there's something I like to think of as like the hourglass approach, where like, what do you want to do in life? Do you want to be a composer? Do you want to be a sound designer? Most people don't know right away. Some people thought they wanted to be composers and then they fall in love with sound design. I did sound design, and most indie games, like at the very beginning, at least if they're small teams, very often they're done by both. I don't do just sound design. And when I do sound design, it's for a game that I'm already doing music for. And because of who I am, most of my sound design ends up being very musical. That's just kind of how I think anyways. So when I think of the hourglass approach, it's like you start wide and then like you slowly hone in on something that you start to both enjoy and are like good at. And then like you, like the thin part is like actually like significantly longer than the rest, but like, you stick with what you're good at for a while, and then once you're like established and comfortable, then you can like start to branch out and do like other stuff that you think is cool and interesting. Like that's how I think of it, at least.
Yeah.
So
it's an interesting way to that's a really clever way to visualize it. I like that a lot.
So yeah, sound design is a process that I find frustrating because I feel like it is the process of doing a full composition, but times a million and like way shorter. Sound designers I've talked to, they're like, I don't like composing because I don't have the ability to like focus on making this full song, and I like the sandboxy feeling of like, how does this sound with this thing, and you mix and match stuff and you put plugins on top. So there's a process called like layering, where you take different sounds and you stack them on top of each other, and there's three parts of a sound, where it's like the transient, which is the front, there's the like the main body, I think it's just called body, and then there's the tail. So then you're like, oh, I like, just say, for example, a gunshot is something that has like a transient that can be like even something that's just like tick, 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 tick. But then they have like a lot more body and tail, like depending on how far and how big the gunshot is. Like that's just like something that like if you see. Also, like guns in video games don't sound like guns in real life.
Mm-mm. Yeah,
they almost always layer real gun sound effects, but then there's a whole nother process.
Mm-hmm. Right, because these things serve mechanical purposes right. in the game. It's not purely an effort to make things sound either realistic or even realistic to the world or theming of the game. A lot of it has to do with the game design, because it can really impact the player's direct mm-hmm. experience.
Yeah. It's a form of gameplay feedback, really.
Exactly.
More than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not just about like being good at audio stuff. Like, it's about like, are you able to work directly with the game designers and developers on making sure that they have that process of back and forth. So it's not just different technically, the whole process is different, mm-hmm. right?
I think especially sound design is really tricky, because like there's to an extent it's like really good sound design you don't notice, but at the same mm-hmm. time there are also like specific mm-hmm. sounds that will like stick in your brain forever. Some of that is particularly like UI stuff can be interesting, or like a very specific action. So like if you just think about the rings of Sonic and has like a very distinct pickup sound,
right?
You think about the Metal Gear Solid alert sound, that's a really distinct one too.
Mm-hmm.
But a mm-hmm. lot of times, like even as an audio person, I'll like not even think about how something sounds, because I'll just be deeply immersed in a thing. And I remember specifically, like I think it was Marshall McGee has a lot of videos. But he talked about how in Uncharted, there's a point where like they throw a rope, and you can throw a rope and swing from different places. And when you throw that rope, it has like this sort of whip sound. And of course, like in real life, when you throw a rope, there's like barely any sound to it at all. Mm-hmm. But like in the moment, that doesn't matter. It doesn't need to matter, because you get this feedback and it has a snap to it. And you're like, all right, I'm like ready to go and ready to climb and whatever.
Yeah, like sword swings don't sound right. like anything either, right? But movies and television have convinced us otherwise for a long time. So it's not, you know, it's just about like making it seem real. And in a game, that means that feedback as well.
I think it's more about like making it feel impactful than making mm-hmm. it feel real. Because like, mm-hmm. I don't know, like when you watch a movie and like somebody shoots a silenced pistol, it makes a little sound or whatever. And it's like very exaggerate in how quiet that.
Wait, what was that? Do that again. Okay, thanks.
So it's very exaggerate in how like it's silenced, but like a silenced pistol in real life is not like that. I think the purpose of that is so as the watcher, as somebody viewing the movie, they understand that this pistol is quiet and it's intended for other people to not hear it. So like, it is an additional like. It's more feedback, it's additional feedback, so the
right has a narrative function,
yeah so that the right. people yeah. understand what that the purpose of that is. And it goes the same with like game design and in video games too, where like the rope thing, like Chell was saying, it just tells the player that you're doing something with your button press and it's causing something impactful to happen at this moment. That's how I see it anyway.
Well, that explains a lot of why, Chell, you're describing people who get into they get into audio and then they go one way or the other, mm-hmm. and probably one tends to have difficulty with the other as time goes on, because they are not the same in any way. But very frequently you're called upon to do both, especially at indie
mm-hmm.
scale,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you have to find your way to be good at both, even if, you know, you hate it.
Yeah.
That's all you have to say about that?
I mean, like, there are some people that do enjoy both and they do both, but it is typically at a certain level one seems to take precedence over the other.
Yeah.
Like I know at A Shell in a Pit is a company that has done a lot of audio in general for like several games. Like they did the sound design for Night in the Woods, they did both the music and the sound design for Wander Song. But the same studio that made Wander Song, they're now making a game called Chicory. The music is done by Lena Rain, but they still have a Shell and Pit doing the sound design for that. So I think for them, at least, sound design is like sometimes they do a whole audio package, but I think typically the sound design is what they are like at least maybe prioritized for. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And then like what you're describing, those sound effects that you had to then go in and do additional design on to line up with the music in Kine. like establishing those kinds of workflows amongst like an audio department is an interesting challenge for folks at indie and you know and slightly higher scale of projects, is making sure that communication between people works even when you are hiring people for different things, because the sound of a game still has to feel like it comes from one voice even mm-hmm. when those things are very different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish we had a sound designer at work, because we have to just do that ourselves. And like, I wasn't really hired to make or find sounds. It's a whole involved process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think solo devs, you know, they find their sound effects on Freesound, mm-hmm. and that's cool. Like,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah.
But you know, just like it's okay if you don't know everything. That's true if you know nothing. Like you just have to know that's what it is. You know.
Yeah.
I think a little bit can go a long way, and I would recommend that. But yeah, I think people are very, very frequently in the position of not knowing that it's worthwhile to hire somebody or to put some real effort into it, because like Chell, you were saying, good sound design, you don't notice. And so it's the same with like good editing in film. Like,
yes,
people don't appreciate it enough, you know?
I still don't know enough about editing, but then like when I see someone explain stuff, and then I don't know, like as I've gotten older, a good editor for like visual media or like linear media is something that I still need to appreciate more. But a producer is someone that I'm like, oh God, how do things ever survive? It's because producers, God, producers, they're the best.
Yeah.
They keep things organized.
That's a lesson you learn over and over in indie. Like if you're on a small team or you're a solo dev, you start like appreciating those niche roles one by one over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Sure. As you try to take them on yourself, like, this will be fine. I can do this too. Nope. I mean, maybe you can get away with it. You know?
Well, that's a question I want to ask actually, Chell. With respect to like composing and the sound design, how did you coordinate with the Kind team and other teams to like get everything to feel like a whole piece?
So for the most part, I was supposed to do the entire audio. She, when she got grant money, she ended up hiring like a art studio that she outsourced some like work to. Mm-hmm. She hired a friend that he helped do like the second pass for the audio systems. And so I did like a minor amount of tweaking within it. Like, oh, I want these sound effects to be like randomized, and I want like whatever, or some stuff like that. Minor pitch randomization. Typically he did actually most of like the engine stuff. And in addition, he also did some sound effects. As for making them blend together, to be perfectly honest, I don't think they do.
Oh,
I think it sounds good. I think it sounds good, but I won't say that I think that they necessarily blend together, but I don't think that matters. It's interesting because normally I feel like UI stuff is really dry, and when you hover over things, really nice piano stuff plays over it. And so he did the piano stuff on the UI, actually. This is Patrick Balthrop, by the way. And so Patrick did some of the piano stuff. I'm trying to think what else. He took some of my recordings and he implemented in and then like made them really reverb-y. Mm. So I think in general, it's not so much as like you take a thing and you take another thing and you figure out a way to match them together. It's more of a collaborative thing, especially for sound designers, because like if it's a big enough team, you'll have multiple sound designers. The mm-hmm. studio that I was working at, we had two sound designers and there was me, and so like they knew each other quite well, and they could at least like there's good communication all across the board.
Okay.
And when it got to implementation, they were going to do a process of like trying to figure out how does the sound effect sound over the music and all sorts of other technical stuff, like do we gate stuff, I don't know. We never actually got there because we all got laid off.
Hmm.
Ah.
Dang. Rough.
Bummer.
But it was good while it lasted, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I've definitely had work experiences like that where like it's like, well, the whole thing was a disaster. But there were parts, you know, that you like take with you as like good examples going forward.
I love the audio team.
Very diplomatic.
Ellen, who is Brandon Sanderson?
Oh my gosh, he's a great, great novelist.
Okay, because y'all were talking about that on the Nice Games Club Discord channel, and I don't know who that is, so.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of fun things on the Nice Games Club Discord channel, and sometimes we talk about, well, probably going to talk about him pretty often or the next month or so, Brandon Sanderson, writer of all the Cosmere novels.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's not just games up in here. It's all sorts of nerdy stuff.
But there is games talk, though, still, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
We definitely talk about, like, some people have been bringing up, like, ideas they've had for the games that they've been working on recently, and, like, what it takes to start it, or what kinds of your goals for what your projects are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really fascinating discussion to follow.
Yeah, it's been fun. Like, ever since we started this, like, the show episodes will, like, seed an idea, but then that's not always where people will take it. And that's fantastic to see people, like, ask questions and start discussions, and we pop in, but it's really about the community around Nice Games Club, and it's been really, really cool to see, and people like putting their project ideas and what they're feeling and what they're thinking, and then off topic stuff as well. It's been really, really cool to see. I mean, it's just a shame that like membership is closed, that no one else can be in there. I mean, otherwise we would like we'd tell people about it, right?
Oops, I opened it up. Anyone can access it now. You just have to go to nicegames.club/discord.
You're telling me it's not an exclusive club?
No. Anyone can be a part of it. Yeah,
wow.
Sorry.
Well, you have to be nice and you have to be awesome. It's exclusive in that way.
That's true. That's
well,
true.
How does one get there?
Nicegames.club/discord.
Well, hold on. I don't know if I heard that quite correctly. What was that address one more time?
Nicegames.club/discord.
Oh, thanks. Well, I think before we wrap up, I want to talk about sort of a big topic about video game music and what makes it different from music in general. And I think this is something that is... In my conversations with other people, there's sort of been there's some like tentacle answers to this, but mostly it's kind of like a ephemeral kind of notion. And I would like to hear your thoughts, which is like, what makes video game music special or unique as a genre, even though itself encompasses all genres of music?
Yeah. So, I guess, so there's a sort of a creative way to answer this question. And there's also a technical way to answer this question. A real quick technical one is, interestingly enough, programming is the biggest one because of implementation and how things are triggered. And my specialty, because I don't like to specify into a single genre, is that I do music with lots of layers. The kind soundtrack layers vertically, and so new layers get added on top. But also, since the baseline is constant, there are a bunch of different layers that happen over the same baseline. And so it's technically one big modular song. And so I've just kind of been like, that was an idea that I came up with. And then I'm like, oh, geez, this is hard. And then I did it. And now for every game, I'm like, how do I make layers a thing? So that's like a technical answer of like programming and getting all that to work. I don't do programming myself, but like someone has to. For like the actual writing process, there's a couple of things. One, in general, most music loops, but video game music has to loop well. If you listen to a top 40 song, there's usually an intro, there's an intro, a verse, a chorus, verse two, chorus two, bridge, sometimes a breakdown, and then last chorus, and then exit or outro, whatever, fade out sometimes.
Yeah.
Video game music is usually it doesn't ever get to the bridge part. It always just loops. I also have the super controversial opinion that Super Mario Galaxy is an overrated game and that its soundtrack is overrated.
I can't believe you found a way to get that into this episode, Chell.
Look, <Let's go. laughs> I like Sunshine. I know you don't, but I'm going to say, so I have a point to this. I have a point to this. And the reason
You'd
is because
better.
I have a point to this. In Mario Galaxy 2, the first level has a song that drives me insane. And the reason is because it has, it builds and it builds and it has this big crescendo into this very big final feeling cadence. And it's just like, and has all this drum and stuff like that. And then it transitions into the soft oboe solo. And then that transitions into a clarinet solo. And then blah, 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 and stuff. It goes and it goes and it starts to build and it builds and it builds and it builds. And then big triumphant cadence. And then it goes into the oboe solo and then the clarinet solo. And I heard this song loop 8 times. I wanted to just mess around with the physics and have fun. And just like, oh, you know, new game. Like, how's it compared to Galaxy 1 and blah, blah, blah. And all this stuff. And like, oh, you know, you have all this fun excitingness. And I could subconsciously count how many times a song loops. That is, oh, God.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to defend that particular track in Galaxy. But one of the things I love about the Galaxy soundtrack is that it, and this is where maybe we're at odds with this, because video game music does loop, and that makes me nervous sometimes because it makes me feel like it tamps down the creative possibilities for music to move, like to have phases. Yeah. And I think, and that's, and there's a practical reason for that, right? Because you, the designer doesn't always know, unless it's a really complicated development process, doesn't always know what music is playing at what moment of gameplay. So they have less control over that. Mm-hmm. What I love about the Galaxy music, a lot of it anyway, is that it does move in a way that creates user stories. So I play a little bit differently, and the game doesn't really care, but like there's a particular part of the music that's a little heightened, and I'm playing a part of the level that then I create the connection as the player between that. And that's what I really like about that music. And I like when video game music does that, but I find a lot of video game music forgettable because it is designed to live in the background.
Interesting.
And I have a lot of difficulty with that. I hear people talk all the time about, oh, this is my favorite video game soundtrack. And I'm like, people have favorite video game soundtracks? Like, there's such a craft and loving dedication and so much ungodly talent in video game music. Mm-hmm. But it is by design meant to not be as memorable as a top 40 hit or something. And that's doing its job. Mm. And so I find it kind of difficult. And so I love music that gets to do a little bit more and takes a risk of like coming out of the background a little bit. So, but maybe that's a controversial opinion amongst people who are into video game music.
I have several thoughts because I feel that way about film music, except for specific film soundtracks that I think are particularly memorable and stellar. Like the Amelie soundtrack is so nice. It's so pretty.
Yeah, that's great. I like that one.
And my sister, I talked to this about my sister, and she's like, what about the Shape of Water soundtrack? I'm like, I hadn't seen Shape of Water at the time. And she played it for me like, yeah, this has a lot of character, and this is really nice. And it adds a huge layer of depth. But not to call out a specific movie, I watched Ant-Man and Wasp with my... Mm-hmm. I was watching that movie, and the way I see the music in that game, and a lot of film music, it is like shredded lettuce. Provides a layer of texture, but no nutritional content.
Yep.
And it's just like, oh, you have like the violins that like kind of play along this one specific ditty to the actions of the movie. But like, it's just like, it's there to provide a new layer. It's just not a very interesting one. Sure. Like shredded lettuce.
Doesn't stand on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that like the Marvel movies in general probably aren't great examples of depth.
I will say that like the game music, it depends on the game.
I think
more modern stuff, like I don't know any of the music in Uncharted besides the main theme. I don't know like any of the music in Last of Us, sorry to the composers of Naughty Dog. Like one of the most famous songs of all time is probably the Mario Bros. Song. It is just super memorable, is written in a way that's memorable. And Koji Kondo himself listened to it for like 8 hours straight to see if he would get sick of it, because that game has like 4 songs. There's other, I mean, I just think that in general, like if a video game, memorability comes from how often you hear something and how singable it is, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And like, I guess various textures and whatnot. I think that the, like if I think about like a song in Kingdom Hearts, Traverse Town is the main hub world that you go back to, and it has like this very warm, cozy clarinet melody, and it just feels like it's one of those places that you just like pause the game and get a snack and you just hear the music in the background for a long time. And it's fine because it loops well, and it's got smoothness to it. So I would like to think that the music that I wrote for Kind might be in a sort of specifically weird position because it kind of literally all blends together because it is kind of technically all one song. But I would like to think that at least other music I've written, like the melodies, I feel like I'm very much melody focused because like a lot of times I straight up just sing a melody or I'll have an idea in my head and I'll like sing it out and I'll write it down. I don't know. That's my personal take on it. So I'm not to say that you're wrong, Mark, but I don't. But Sunshine is good.
Sunshine is not good, and this is my show.
Oh boy, I get this is also my show, and I say Sunshine is good.
Yeah, two versus one.
I quit.
The music in Sunshine is quite good.
Yeah,
all Mario music is good. It's a little bit too tropical, like every damn thing about that game.
I mean, yeah,
the whole game takes place on an island. At least I remember every single section of Sunshine. I cannot remember any more than like six galaxies across two Mario Galaxy games.
Because it's a linear game. That's by design. It doesn't make you memorize it. Like that's a feature,
and
not a
this
bug.
This is why Galaxy frustrates me, because it's disguised as a 3D Mario game Sunshine in 64, but it's actually a linear game where like the new Super Mario Bros. And New Land or whatever, like Mario 3D Land, I cannot remember those names for the life of me.
So a bunch of people at Nintendo got together and said, hey, you know what people love is water levels. So let's make a whole game.
Chow, I think we just became best friends because I agree with you completely.
There's not like you are all of your frustration videos were in Rico Harbor, which is arguably like the most technically frustrating place. And it is also the place with the most water.
I was like, oh, listeners who don't know, I've been playing Sunshine for the first time fully through. Mm-hmm. I gave up on it the first time I played it, but I'm like, I clearly didn't give it enough a chance. All Mario games are classics, and I'm playing through it again, and it's the hardest thing I've done
but
in my life.
But you're playing a worse version that doesn't have various... I think there's something about inverting the camera, and also because the Switch doesn't have analog triggers, it makes certain things just harder.
Oh, yeah, is kind of rough. I'm trying to give it the benefit of the doubt there. But like when, I posted a bunch of videos from this terrible, terrible level that's garbage and sucks. And then I was like, you know what? Maybe I'm being too hard. It's one of dozens of levels. And there's like, what, 8, 9 levels in Sunshine? So it's a pretty big part of the game. Anyway, I don't know if we're going to cut this all out or not.
I think there's 7 main worlds and then a bunch of secrets. If I count it correctly. Whereas Mario 64 has, I think, well, now I have to count that one.
Well, while you're doing that, I do want to say that I'm really with you on this idea of melody. Because I think one of the things that frustrates me about film music also, I think Marvel movies are a great example of this, is music that doesn't seem to have a point of view, that just kind of wants to get through. It's like, it is that shredded lettuce that's sort of like the condiment ready to kind of just take you along. It does its job and no more.
Yeah.
And so I really, really love music in video games and in movies that find a way to make themselves known and not just be background music because the scene needs background music, become actually a holistic part of the scene.
15
and
worlds.
In games, that's hard, right? Yeah.
It's 15.
What was that?
15 and 64.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is interesting because like I agree with that. I think that like I do think that video game music is intended to loop, so it's supposed to be something you hear in the background. But I think Chell has a point in that because you hear the same song over and over and over again, it starts to become memorable. I've noticed that like when I like jump into a game and I like for the like my impression of the music for the first time, I'm like, oh, I don't like this song. I'll like if I play it for long enough, I start playing it for an hour or something, I'll start humming along with it. And then I'm like, what is the song doing to me?
Yeah.
And not even just on the composer, but sometimes the game itself. Like Grant Kirkhope is pretty consistent. And most of his songs, like those songs get stuck in your head super hard. They're all very memorable. They all have a great texture to them. And they all are very melodic. But then I think about like, so the Journey soundtrack, I can remember the first song and the last song particularly well. Yeah. And then a lot of things in the middle I can't remember as well because it is kind of it like that song is it's supposed to blend into like one song overall. Abzu is another game where it's like very flowery and it goes all sorts of places because you're underwater and it's pretty, but I can't sing any of it. But but Tooth and Tail, same composer, Austin Wintory, has some hard bops in the Tooth and Tail song. And that's like gritty Russian Revolution, like it's so weird and different, and I love it.
Yeah. And now I think about it, like, a lot of times with video game soundtracks, if I don't remember the actual song itself, I'll remember the feeling I had from the song, but not like the song itself. Like you brought up Journey, Chell, and like that reminds me, I can't remember any of the songs in Journey, but I remember the emotions I was feeling while I was playing the game. And I think, and I remember that the soundtrack had a large part in that, even though I don't remember any of the music specifically.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. The moment matters more than like what you take away, like what you remember later, I guess.
I think that's comparable to movies too, honestly. Because like, I think there are like some soundtracks where I don't remember the specific song, but I remember like the music came in conjunction with what was happening in the movie, and it made me remember, and it made me feel those emotions again.
By that same token, like the one memorable part of the Avengers soundtrack is like its main, like the that one main melody in its theme, and then nothing else in that. But I cannot tell you where that happens in the movie.
That's very true.
But I do remember that melody. So like it's kind of pointless, right?
It's not a great.
I was gonna say also, like, part of my frustration with film music is the fact that I have also done a lot of recording for, like, at Berkeley they have some like film student recording stuff, and so I've gone and recorded stuff with them, and they only have the trombones in for this one scene in one of the Hunger Games films, and it's like when this one guy dies. And so I've played music for when this one guy dies for hours.
Yeah,
and they're all different. Some of them are like, wow, this person has like the writing is good, and like blah blah. And a lot of times it's just like, man, I feel like film music doesn't have this sort of heart and soul where it's just like it's almost too contextual. And it's very specific to a moment where I wouldn't like necessarily go back and like listen to it for like kicks. Like, I mean, musicals are different, but like a lot of times if it's too contextualized, then there's not enough emotion attached to it. I mean, this is all extremely subjective.
Oh yeah.
And so someone might completely be like, wow, I now hate Chell for her terrible opinions about film music and Sun and Galaxy. I said I'm right about Galaxy, so
well, I'll leave that to me editing this episode later. Oh, dip, Ellen's editing this one. We haven't heard Ellen's thoughts yet, but I think when you talk about that contextual element, I think that's one of the things I want from video game music, is to be very contextual, which is why I find it difficult to listen to video game music outside of that context. But at the same time, you're still right. Like,
I'm always right.
All right, let's not go too far. There's no reason it has to be one or the other. And this goes all the way back to when we were talking about like your setup and your workflow. Like, what, there isn't one answer for all situations, right? Sometimes you want that music that only works in that moment, because that's the way to best achieve what that moment needs. And sometimes you want to have music that can live outside on its own, because that has its own special value.
Yeah.
Right?
A lot of people like listening to video game music to study to, because it loops naturally and it's usually pretty level. And that's why also lo-fi is another genre that people like to listen to with studying, because it's level and it can loop well. I mean, not the looping part is like optional, but like,
yeah,
I mean, like, I think about the Undertale soundtrack. I studied that soundtrack because I had to conduct it at some point. I say had to. I wanted to, and it was great, but I conducted it, and it was, God, there's so much stuff in that soundtrack, because it like has all these leitmotifs and all these callbacks and stuff like that. But as songs themselves, they're so good. And in context, some of them made me cry.
Yeah.
Like, going and then like hearing songs out of the context of playing the game, but it brings back the memory. I feel like it brings back the memories of these moments. And some of them are easier to sing and more memorable. Other times I'll hear like there's a specific song in Metal Gear Solid 3, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's like when you're in the sort of low alert state, and there's like this kind of nice, like sort of guitar that happens. And I remember the moments and the emotions I felt during those times. I'm like, wow, that sounds cool. And if I hear it out of context, it takes me back to like the feeling of sneaking around and hiding in this Russian jungle. So I don't know. I think it provides context, but I think it also sounds good on its own. And I mean, it depends on the game, but I feel like a lot of the most memorable stuff is memorable for a reason, and not even just for nostalgia.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'm thinking about, like, because I have a giant list or a giant, like, playlist of all of the songs that I've ever liked that are on Spotify. It's like, it's at 5,000 songs or something. No, it's probably higher than that at this point. It's a lot. I just, like, play it when I just want to listen to random things. Mm-hmm. There are some songs on there that are from movies, and I remember specifically the one movie I'm thinking of is If Beale Street Could Talk. I don't know if y'all have seen that movie. It's a good movie, but, like, the soundtrack is amazing. And while I was watching the movie, I kept thinking to myself, man, this soundtrack is amazing. And I don't know if it's, and I don't know if it's because there wasn't something going on interesting enough in the movie for me to notice the soundtrack as much or what. But I've noticed that, like, I'll do that for movies, and I'll do that for some games, too. That, like, I'll just notice that the sound, the music is good, or the sounds are good or something. Even if I don't necessarily, even if in the moment I might not be feeling that game or movie or whatever at the time. So
for movies, I feel like it's usually one or two songs that really stick out to me because of the very specific moments. Like, oh, it's the main theme. Maybe something else is happening.
Yeah.
Even with Amelie, I can only think of like two songs. Maybe a third one, too. At least with games, I feel like because there's a lot of variety in the worlds. Depends on what kind of games you're playing. But I feel like because there's a lot of different moments and there's a lot of different, if it's less linear than like a hallway of a game, I feel like, I mean, like people think about Final Fantasy VII, let's just take VII because it's a beloved game. And like, there's certain things, there's like the main theme, there's the bombing mission, there's the fight music, there's the boss music, there's like the final boss music and leading to the final boss. Like, these are all themes that I can think of and recall very easily. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of moments in between, because that game's so long. So a lot of moments in between starting the game and fighting Sephiroth and winning. And I can't remember all the music in that, but I remember a lot of it.
Yeah. There's something to it. I think part of it is a lot. I think a lot of it is the, you hear it a lot in a game versus a movie.
Ellen, you had a thought ready to go?
Chell, where can people send their opinions on what you said today to you on the internet?
So my website is chellwongaudio.com. And it has all of my links to like my Bandcamp, my Spotify, which unfortunately I'm going to have two Spotify's because I'm going to have two names. On there is a contact form where I can filter out the emails. I am, however, on Twitter and on Instagram, but mostly Twitter at Chellwong Audio. And if you want to send me your hot takes on video game music, film music, Galaxy, Sunshine, or you think I have the best opinions and you're like, wow, I totally agree with you, then I guess Twitter is the best way to find me typically, but I'm pretty easily reachable everywhere.
And you have been, I'm not sure how widely you want to advertise this, but you have been playing Mario 64, a 120 star run every week on Twitch, right?
Yeah. So I'm skipping this coming week because it's going to be Game Sound Con. But essentially Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, I and a friend named Tiffany Otto, I'm going through Super Mario 64. And I love that game. That game is... It's like my first or second favorite. The only other one being like Paper Mario 1000 Year Door that can really compete. But despite Super Mario 64 being like my favorite game of all time, I've never gotten 120 stars. I'm stuck at 118 on my N64. So I've decided to go through and start from the beginning since there's like everyone's talking about it again. I'm like, hey, why not? I might as well. So right now I'm at 65 stars as of the recording of this podcast, and I need to go to Dire Docks next and then finish the basement out with Bowser. So that's where I'm at right now. And then afterwards, I'm going to play Sunshine, hopefully. Tiffany said that she might do Luigi's Mansion. So maybe we'll take turns. I don't know.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, that is... Oh, okay. This is annoying. My Twitch username is PenguinBuster, and it's PENGWNBUSTER. That is going to be... That will change to Chellwong Audio eventually, but... You can only change your username like once in 30 days, and I changed it from my old handle to my new handle, and then I started streaming. I'm like, oh, dog. Now it's impossible to find me. And I don't really care. Like, I'm streaming mostly just for kicks. So yeah, that's like my other thing that I'm doing for kicks. But everywhere else, it's chaowangaudio.com or Twitter, chaowangaudio. Bandcamp is just chaowang.bandcamp.com. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Check her out in all of those places.
That's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics, both controversial and not. If you liked this episode, give us a review on your favorite podcast app and tell your friends. Independent podcasts like ours rely on word of mouth to grow. We love hearing from our listeners. So for a quick way to give us feedback on the show, head over to nicegames.club/feedback. You know it by now. And fill out a short little form. You can also get in touch with your nice hosts on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and hashtag environmentober. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Ask us questions, suggest topics, or just say hello.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
I thought for as off the rails as we went, we stayed on topic more or less.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.